Welcome to the Oral History Review at the Oxford University Press blog. Occasionally, we like to break up the monotony of text posts with a podcast, celebrate the oral and oral history, so to speak. With these podcasts, we hope to give the Oral History Review's authors and editors a place to elaborate on or build upon their scholarship. Furthermore, as with all of our social media efforts, we aim to build awareness of the art and craft of oral history. The following podcast is hosted by Troy Reeves, the Oral History Review's managing editor and head of the Oral History Program at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Enjoy.
Thanks, Caitlin. Today we're talking to Doug Boyd. I could spend a lot of time here listing his accomplishments and his various titles, but as always, he has a lot of good stuff to say. So without further ado, here's Doug. All right, Doug, we're going to talk to you today about the special issue of the Oral History Review entitled Oral History in the Digital Age. Since that comes from a website of the same name, perhaps we can start by telling folks how you became involved in OHDA.
Sure. The OHDA initiative was originated out of the Matrix Center at Michigan State University, and they had submitted an application to IMLS proposing a project to explore best practices for oral history in the digital age. And after a couple of rounds, you know, I think in the second round it was approved by IMLS. And essentially my role became, you know, I was at the University of Kentucky at the time, which is where I am now. And it really became about, you know, finding someone to manage the project, the intellectual side of the project, and how this best practices initiative going to sort of take shape. And so ended up contracting with me at the University of Kentucky to lead the initiative from that perspective. It really involved, you know, an advisory group, 15 individuals from a variety of institutions. Some of them were from the partner institutions on the grant, Library of Congress's American Folklife Center, Smithsonian Folklife Center, the Oral History Association, and the American Folklore Society. We're all partners. And group leaders were chosen, you know, from the various domains that were represented by the grant. So we had some folks from libraries and museums and folks from the folklore background, as well as the more traditional oral historians, and sort of brought everybody together. And it was sort of this big mishmash of expertise, thinking, okay, we got to get these best practices together, which is pretty overwhelming in the beginning to think, okay, how are we going to do this? And is this going to be best practices on everything? Because everything in oral history is dependent on technology at this point. And so really it was, in the beginning, a wonderful sort of, okay, how do we do this? And so we ended up in the first face-to-face meeting really breaking down the original grant proposal and breaking it apart and completely restructuring it in new and exciting ways, I think, to build up a sort of new model of best practice, you know, that wouldn't be this prescriptive and you should do this and you should do this, because, you know, oral history out in the real world is practiced by a variety of groups with a variety of budgets, with a variety of infrastructure. In some ways, I structured it in many ways the way I structure my life. And I think, you know, thinking about it from a Starbucks perspective, because I'm Starbucks obsessed as this sort of tall, grande, and venti, because oral histories come in all shapes and sizes from all budgets, from a small county historical society all the way up to the Shoah Foundation, which has incredible amounts of money that they're putting towards oral history. So how can you say this is the best way to do it in a way that not everybody can afford? So I think really, you know, breaking that down and thinking through how can we create something that's really empowering for all groups that practice oral history, that's within reach, that provides options, that's interactive, that is dynamic, can be changed, and as the circumstances change. So I think as we began to sort of move in that direction and think this is kind of a new model for best practices, it's no longer just the printed thing that the grant agency prints out and it's the guide and you just print, you know, flip to page 38 of the guide. It really becomes something that's more dynamic and hopefully is going to grow. I think now that the website, and you mentioned the name of the website, but I really like to think of it as the project, because the project is more than just the website. It's things like the videos. It's things like the special issue. That's going to sort of become more of an organic process with the website at the center, bringing it all together. But seeing OHDA, the initiative, as really more a variety of elements that, again, are easily updatable, changeable, and linkable in these new and dynamic ways.
And thanks, Doug. I want to get to the issue, obviously, the special issue of the Oral History Review. But I want you to talk a little bit more about the website, maybe specifically how someone who doesn't know oral history yet or thinks they know oral history but want to learn more about it, how accessible is the website, or how have you made it more accessible to newcomers to the field?
You know, there's no holding back on the fact that it contains a massive amount of information. So we tried to architect the website in a very user-friendly fashion. Really at the heart of the project are the 72 essays on a variety of elements pertaining to collecting, curating, and disseminating oral history. If you're interested in the latest, you can go to the articles on, you know, collecting, or if you're just interested in the archiving, you can go to the section on curating and get all that information. But there's also access to over 200 best practices documents accessible through the website, whether it's video, whether it's archives, whether it's hardcore digital preservation. We try to get best practices documented, or best practice documents aggregated, if they had any kind of tangential connection to oral history. And so that's, you know, if you really want to get into the technical side of things, that's a great place to go. We've brought together over 200 examples of model uses of oral histories online, which I think is a great location, because I think the model is a great way to think about this. There's no one way to present oral history online, but there are all these wonderful, exciting ways to do it. So here's a list of 200 projects that you can go check out and see if you would be interested in modeling or following up further on. The website has built on a tagging system, and so every resource is tagged, and so you really can follow. You can create playlists of your favorite articles. If you're just getting started, people have created, I think, a getting started playlist for some of those intro resources. Dip your toe in, or if you want to dive right in on hardcore technical stuff, you can do that as well. So it's very searchable. It's tagged, and so it works just like what we're all familiar with regard to tagging and categorization. Oh, and it also has a couple other resources through the website, like the video series Thinking Big, which we did a series of interviews with some of these experts in their field, and some of them inside oral history, but some of them also outside of oral history, that yielded some really exciting resources that presented some of the best practices information back in a dynamic, cool video fashion that's really engaging. And there's, I think, a model tool also that we put up there on the website called Ask Doug, which is modeled after the 21 questions that I would ask people when they call me and say, which recorder should I buy? I really put everybody through a sort of interview process, because it's never an easy answer. It depends on so many different factors, and we've automated that process now in a cool way. It's a little bit like online dating. It's like eHarmony.com, where you fill out a survey, and the system will actually tell you which recorder Doug would recommend for you and your budget and your level of expertise. And I really think that's kind of the first of those kind of tools. I think I really want to see something up there that pertains to video, that pertains to microphones, that pertains to all kinds of different. I'd love to see that kind of thing for digital preservation strategy, or even as we get into the realm of legal and ethical. More seriously, I think it'd be great to have a resource online that was more dynamic, walking people through decision trees that are really empowering. So it's a variety of resources on the website that are really easy to use and intellectually stimulating. Now, some of the articles really were more how-to, practical type of articles and case studies, but it became really clear at some point that there were these scholarly conversations happening as well. And that's where we really started to formulate the idea of a special issue, when we started seeing some of these articles come in that were different in some ways, that were really asking larger questions and presenting things in a way that I think really would have an impact on the scholarly conversation about oral history and digital technology. So that was really exciting, and that really opened the door to this special issue.
Great, and that leads nicely to a little bit more discussion of the special issue. So you were guest editor, but I guess you decided that wasn't enough. You had to actually write a piece as well. So,
right.
But let's start with your own piece and the work you've been doing there at University of Kentucky.
Sure. The article is about OHMS, O-H-M-S, which is the system that we created at the University of Kentucky that tries to sort of make oral history, online use of oral history, more effective and more efficient, but also on the flip side, makes archival preparation on the online use more efficient, more effective, and especially more cost-effective potentially. But really thinking about the user experience, because I really found that just merely throwing up audio that's 3 hours long really still requires the user to put in an incredible amount of energy to use oral history. Oral history has not always traditionally been the easiest historical resource to use. It's very difficult to scan 3 hours of audio like you can scan 100 pages of text. So the first version of OHMS really created a space where it connected that textual hit a textual search in a transcript to the moment. Because I really found that people in our archival environment were, if there was a transcript, they wouldn't go back to the audio because it wasn't easy to do. They had to find their place in the transcript, and then they had to manually locate that location in the audio file. The majority of users said, oh, you have a transcript, just send me that. And that's really problematic because transcription can be flawed in terms of accuracy. So I always really liked the idea of having the user connecting to the transcript while simultaneously being able to have and dynamically interact between the transcript and the audio or video file online. And so we created the system that did just that. You search on the word bourbon, it takes you to the moment when the master distiller mentions the word bourbon in the transcript, connecting to that moment, the corresponding moment in the audio video file, which is really great. The problem was Ohms was only ours. We had put 400 interviews or so in that system, or 500 at that point, and it was only ours, and so I could go and talk about it and say, hey, this is great, look at this, isn't this great, but nobody else could use it. And the other problem is I couldn't afford to transcribe on the scale that we'd been transcribing on, and Ohms was predicated on connecting text in a transcript to moments. And so when we rolled out the new version, it really focuses on indexing. It sort of likens it to the old cassette tape logs that we used to do, where we'd go and listen and try to correspond the counter number in the old cassette days, the counter number on the cassette player, to content so that the user could efficiently go through and get to the information that they're trying to discover. Now that we're in an online environment, the Ohms indexing system allows you to really create segments, give those segments titles, partial transcripts, write a synopsis, subjects and keywords. You can upload a thesaurus. So we have uploaded Library of Congress subject headings for our subjects field, and it will autofill LC terms, so you can control the vocabulary in terms of people indexing. We just are getting ready to upload an amazing collection on the desegregation of Major League Baseball. Well, stadiums don't show up in your standard LC thesaurus, but everybody's talking about the teams and the baseball terms and stadiums, and so what we did was we created a customized thesaurus that contained all these baseball-specific terms and uploaded that for keywords. And so you really can control the vocabulary in a very high-level way, which is really exciting. And then in addition to subjects and keywords, you can do hyperlinks and GPS coordinates. And so if you wanted to have the user link out to Yankee Stadium on a map, they could do that. Or Yankee Stadium during 1945 photos, they could do that. They were online. And so it really, we can index an interview or a collection for one-tenth of the price that we were transcribing. I really love the fact that we can get through a collection faster, more efficiently, in some ways more effectively. Somebody can talk about life under segregation for 3 hours without ever mentioning the word segregation. And so an index is basically somebody's gone through and been able to sort of map that natural language to concepts that are going to really resonate with researchers. And that's not to say the keyword search isn't important. And so my best case scenario is you have the index with a transcript at the same time, and then you get the best of both worlds. So the user can quickly browse an interview through an index and then shoot over to the transcript to really do a targeted keyword search. So if you have both elements, Ohms lets you do that. And so the article is really about kind of changing our paradigm in terms of our workflow and changing the user paradigm in terms of the way that we have always traditionally interacted with oral history. I gave a presentation today and I was talking about Ohms indexing, and I likened it to going to the grocery store. You know, when you go to the grocery store and you say, where are the Cheerios? What do they say? They say aisle 10, you know, the cereal aisle. Then you, the smart human being, follow the signs, interpret the language, and find your way to the Cheerios. And I think the Ohms indexing system is really about that. It's about getting you to the grocery store aisle so that you can discover the content that you want to find, but doing that in a way that's cost-effective on the archive side, that's efficient on the archive side, but really user-friendly on the user side. And we've really accomplished that. I'm really excited about the directions that we've gone with it. So the article really tries to grapple, I think, with that shift in terms of our paradigm and in terms of how users interact with oral history in the future. So exciting and gratifying for me to actually work that out in article form.
Yeah, while the transcriptionists may not be completely in favor of what you're trying to do. I think you might be able to get General Mills to do some heavy sponsorship if you keep using the Cheerios
right.
analogy.
No, I have to say that, you know, I'm a big fan of the transcript, and that's a great point. And I am a big fan of the transcript. It's just brought in 800 interviews last year as a center, and the likelihood that we can transcribe all of them is very small financially. And I think the idea that we withhold effective access to that collection just because we can't afford to transcribe is not scalable. It's not responsible. And so I think being able to come up with a way to present oral history and still in an effective way. The index has advantages. The index has the one disadvantage of not having keyword searchability. And, you know, search engines like Google, users are used to a Google-like search. And so keyword searching is something that's very much in the paradigm of mainstream users. So I do really love the idea of coming back to the transcript. But sometimes it can take us, you know, I've been in oral history a long time. I know sometimes it can take us 15 years to fundraise to transcribe, and still not. You know, we weren't able to fundraise to transcribe these interviews with Major League Baseball players. I mean, that seems like one that would be a no-brainer. And so it just was something that I think, you know, I really grew weary of the idea that, well, if we're not going to put first draft transcripts online and we're only going to, you know, put online interviews that have transcripts, then, you know, we're not effectively serving patrons. And now that we're able to put the interviews online very quickly with the indexing system, then I think now's the time then project administrators like me can then go off and say, you know what, let's try and raise money to transcribe these. And in some ways, when an organization sees interviews go online in the indexed fashion, they get so excited about it that suddenly you can say, hey, let's take this to the next level and take it to the transcript. But in the meantime, which, as we've seen in the archives, oral history archives world, in the meantime can be 15 or 20 years, that interview is not being withheld or is limited or bound by limits in access.
Doug, as usual, you have lots of great things to say about lots of stuff. I think we also need to try to summarize the issue itself. I wonder if you could tell the people who are going to listen about the upcoming next issue of the Oral History Review.
Sure. I mean, it really contains a mixture. It's not just simply more articles for OHDA. These were very different from the case studies and the articles that were written for the original initiative. And I think some of them are able to look down from the 10,000-foot perspective on the whole project, like the article from Mike Frisch and Doug Lambert, and sort of look at the project itself from an analytical standpoint, to case studies that are more than just case studies. And I think the idea that the variety of articles in there were not just, you know, how do I say this? They took their content more into the scholarly conversation. And I think that's where we got really excited. And many of the articles were done as original, not for the original project, but for the special issue. And so they're able to have some perspective. So like Mary Larson's wonderful article on oral history and ethics could utilize the OHDA website in some ways and sort of continue that conversation on another level. And Brooke Bryan wrote a great essay about forging community partnerships, or an article about forging community partnerships in the digital age. So it's not just, and I want to stress that this is not just, ooh, and you should use this system, and this is how you should digitize your interviews. It's really more looking at oral history in the digital age from that thoughtful and scholarly perspective, which really frames things so nicely, because there is something for everyone in the OHDA project. The special issue doesn't mirror the website. The website doesn't mirror the special issue. They all have their different roles in the larger project. And so you're going to get some case studies in the special issue that were picked and sought for this special issue based on the idea that, again, it sort of integrates more into the scholarly discourse. And so, but what I like about that is that it continued the tradition that we started with the website with these sort of more nimble essays. So I think there's 14 different articles in this special issue. Some of them are longer than others. Some of them are very concise. Peter Kaufman's amazing essay on oral history in a video age is an incredible perspective on this sort of video-based culture that we have now and its impact on oral history methodology. And it's a wonderful essay, but it's one of the more concise articles in the issue. And so you're going to get a range of lengths, a range of topics. We did continue the tradition of collecting, curating, and disseminating. This one probably focuses more on curating and disseminating in terms of the scholarly engagement of oral history as primary sources in this. So So I think, you know, it does cover a lot of ground. But again, the journal really is its own thing. It's not supposed to be a greatest hits from the website, and it wasn't intended to be a comprehensive guide. It's a continuation of this initiative, and I think one that we're really all really proud of. It's a great collection of essays. It's a great use of multimedia in scholarly publication, and so I think it really sets the bar pretty nicely for lifting the conversation about oral history and digital technologies.
I think we need to say one more thing. Because not only you're the guest editor of this issue, but you're also our digital initiatives editor. So I wonder if you could comment on the multimedia or the digital aspect of this specific issue.
Sure. I think the ideas that we have, even not with this specific issue, but I think philosophically with the Oral History Review and digital initiatives, is to take scholarly publication and be more mindful about the use of digital technologies in that scholarly engagement. And so the idea is not having just the digital aspect or the multimedia aspect of an article be the, and if you want to see a picture of so-and-so, click here, or if you want to hear their voice, click here. The goal for, I think, all digital initiatives with the Oral History Review, not just this particular issue, is to engage and incorporate the multimedia into the scholarship itself. So not just sort of throwing up clips here and there as fluffy little add-on, it's actually integrated into the scholarship, and in some ways absolutely required to understanding the scholarly argument. So I think this issue is exciting because there's a high volume of multimedia. So we've got video and we have audio. We've got a tremendous amount of web interaction with this particular issue, mainly because the centralizing aspect is that OHDA website. But it's really exciting, you know, to push the boundaries a little bit with the journal and take some leaps forward in the direction of more actively integrating digital media, this amazing oral history resource that we have, into the scholarly publishing model. You know, I think we've done that. We've made some good steps, I think, forward on this issue. And each issue, we're trying to more actively shape that direction and hopefully, I think, begin to shape the direction of scholarly publication in general.
Doug, let's finish up by giving that URL to the Oral History in the Digital Age website.
Sure. It is ohda.matrix.msu.edu. Great way to find it is to Google Oral History in the Digital Age. But the URL, once again, is no www, just ohda.matrix.msu.edu.
And Doug, your article for issue 40.1 of the Oral History Review, which is also subtitled Oral History in the Digital Age, is entitled OHMS, or you like to call it OHMS, Enhancing Access to Oral History for Free.
Yes, and I do want to point out that there are five articles that aren't behind the subscription wall. And so there are five articles from this special issue that can be accessed and hopefully leading people more to subscribe to the journal so that they can see that the level of conversation and the usefulness of these articles is really fantastic. So I think you can preview the issue with some of the articles that are open access, but then I think hopefully that's going to draw some people who don't subscribe into subscribing to the issue. And I think we did push a little bit further to get a few more articles out there in front, but that's because we also had, I think, the most amount of articles in this issue of any issue to date. So 14 articles. Takes the journal in a new, it opens up, I think, a precedent for more articles, which is really cool too.
So Doug Boyd, you are the director of the Louis B. Nunn Center for Oral History at the University of Kentucky Libraries. And I want to thank you very much for chatting with me today. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Troy. Appreciate it.